This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on location with Joan Selby, and this is a debut book we're going to hear from. So, Joan, give us a poem.
Thank you, Grace. I am so honored to be here, and it's so wonderful to have this opportunity. I'm going to start with a poem that I wrote about poetry, which expresses to my ninth grade class that I wrote it for, so that they would get over their groans and moans when we started introducing poetry. This is called The Art of Poetry. It's easy to see what a poem is not words that must rhyme with not and hot, may and day and thee and me. There's more than that to poetry. Some poems have a beat to wake up your feet and make your nose twitch and make your lips curl like you'd open an oyster and pulled out a pearl. And some make you dance by the seat of your pants. In a music, for one, you can have a romance. Others are strange, full of mutter and mirth. In its lair, this is language that's giving birth. Consider a poem like a new pair of eyes, a pair of red mittens, the Nobel Prize. Above all, remember it's just for you, with wishes and lies and dreams that are true. So don't be afraid when it comes to a look at poems that are written inside of a book. A poem is so many things it is not. I know you can't wait to see all that it's got.
That is Joan Selby with advice that would serve all of us. And I'm sure if more ninth graders got that poem, we'd have a little bigger audience for poetry. So, Joan, what is the title of your book and what is in this book?
The title is called Love Warp. And I was looking back on my love life over the years, and I thought, well, you know, some of it's like weaving a tapestry, and the warp has to go in before you can put in the pretty colors and designs of your life. So I started with a quote by Rumi. It says, every morning is a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, because each one has been sent as a guide from the beyond.
And that sets really, the tone
sort of
this book.
Sums it up as we go through the good, the bad, the ugly, the beautiful.
I loved this book. I wondered why it took you so long to put a book out. You've been an aficionado of poetry.
Well, as
why
these poems go back, would you believe, 60 years?
I would.
A range. And I keep, you know, the old doubts that one has in their minds that I'm not good enough. I published a few poems, that's good enough. You know, I don't need to put out a book, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, because it's difficult to put out a book. And, you know, I don't know if it's going to be successful ahead of time. I have to know that before I bother to do it.
But
I was so impressed by the fact that you said you put out groups of 8 poems and you sent them to so many places. And when they came back, you retyped them and you sent them out again. Well, I must say I was too lazy to do that. And that's really what it takes to, you know.
But do you think... what I love the most about this book is your relationship poems. And I am all about relationships in my own plays and my own work. And I wondered, do you need an epic situation to prompt the poem? I know you have everyday poems as well, but is there something about the tumult and the turmoil that gives you the yeast for the poem?
It doesn't need to be on an epic scale. It can be the look on a person's face, a kind of sneer or snide remark or an inability to honor me in some way or an ability to take my hand in a situation. All of that could become a poem. In fact, any of those could have become an epic poem. It didn't need an epic situation.
Joan, I love that answer. I love your whole attitude. Give us a poem.
Okay. Well, I'll start out by saying I wrote a lot of my poems in transition between Frostburg and Hagerstown, between Ohio and Pennsylvania, between. So the car is my metaphor for making transitions, for moving from place to place, for moving from bad to good, from one good relationship to a bad relationship to a good one. So the first one I'll read then is about driving. It's on a day like this, and it's called an outside spring, where the spring, you can tell it's the daffodils are starting to come up, but you're still a little wintry on the inside. An outside spring. I like the colors of collision, blue azure for hope, the wraparound hue of aching heat meeting icicle air, impact of full-color daffodils as they leap from an AM edition of a town I once knew, fog and snow streaming down the trunks of trees in a slither, brown rivers worrying, and racing motors of the season. Yes, I'm racing toward a celebration through tornado tailspins, over rivers that hop their tracks. And as I near my destination, I put on lipstick.
That is a killer last line.
The lipstick will appear in other places throughout the poem, the book, too. So
it is so symbolic of the holding forth the possibility of good, right?
Right.
It's going to be good. If I put on that lipstick, it's going to be good. Let us hear two more in a row so we get a real feeling for Joan Selby. This is really a high holiday for me. I've read this book more than once.
Oh, thank you. This is called Travels with a One-Eyed Man. And I didn't know a person who had a glass eye, and I let him guide us all around and do the driving in a car. So here was the two-eyed person being led around by a one-eyed person. We had lots of good times, but they weren't all advisable.
I like that word. They weren't advisable.
My face flies into the wind in a scarf of laughter as he, the one-eyed man, leads again on bubbles of freeway light. Champagne heads popping in the flush of evening, we swag the nearest traffic light. He slides his hand up the throttle of my leg and shifts. A flutter of white porch chairs tumbles down like petals from the night. He is zealous, wind against my skin, ecstatic murmurs waiting to define the rain of traffic. Sparkling effervescent jewels, unhallowed sights. The convertible leans as if filled with luggage, households of melons, grapes, and vines. Our heads grow larger as we steamroll down the top, rag open the lid, and music spilling flames, we disappear into the night.
You really can write. In the throes of, let's say, a moment, did you take notes about this particular ride, or did you remember it and then write it later, or do you collect images, or did you actually run this event like a film and just write the poem like you remembered it?
I ran it like a film, I think. I really didn't you, everybody used to say, well, you mean you put your poems out, you write all your poems on the typewriter or the computer? Somebody told me that a real poet needs to sit under a tree with a piece of paper and a quill pen and write poems. And I said, no, that's not me. I don't really take notes that much, but now I'm taking notes in the morning. I get up at 5 a.m. and I can't sleep anymore. So I sit there and I think, and I start making notes for my poems. And that's actually been productive too. So I'm willing to try new techniques.
Well, here are 40 pages of unforgettable poems that are like magnets because they are. Do you know what you have here? What I like about this book It is your authenticity. You don't try to be poetic. There's no complaint. There's no self-pity. You just tell what happened and describe it. So it's as pure as poetry can be. And I want to hear another poem.
This one is called To a Veteran. A lot of people could relate to this one. I remember your crooked smile, your radioactive laugh, the puckered scar of a self-inflicted tattoo you wore upon your shoulder like an epaulette. You never said what it was like, wouldn't tell me what you held inside, but today I know what happened to the scarcely grown man inside you. What happened in that place of snakes and jungle, leeches large and black as amputated thumbs? Therefore, I understood your inability to stay in a room, to look me in the face without a faraway glance, like a wound, desires stripped away in a body bag that left you wary of what any love could do. So kisses tasted of despair. Phones brought jarring and tragic news. I understand, but how I wish there was still a you to say this to.
That's what I like. Mm-hmm. Your direct approach. Mm-hmm. So how long after your relationship did you write the poems?
Well, I combined a few relationships, as we're apt to do. I just wrote, that was a fairly recent one, and so it was many years after, but then I met another veteran, and I met a number of veterans, and I've heard the horrible truth that many veterans are still very troubled and have never gotten over that terrible war of ours, and
You make it so much more vivid because you personalize it. To say generically, it's been horrible, they've come back wounded, that says something. But to say the kiss tastes of despair and how the eyes cannot meet your face and you cannot look, you have a faraway look in your eyes, those particulars really tell a story. The book is Love Warp. And as Joan says, in weaving, there has to be a warp to make the wool. So have some more poetry from Joan Selby.
Yes. Actually, I found a poem last night that I had written a number of years ago. And I thought this should have been in my book. So I would like the permission to read this before I read my next poem out of the book. And I'll need to look at it more because it's called A Float. I didn't title it our last anniversary. I think A Float works better. As I was still floating very much with my feelings about this marriage. I don't remember much about our last anniversary, the one that I knew was probably the last. But your peeved face seems to drift now into the flutter and kick and paddle away into our paddle boat's wake on that sunny October day at the Alpine Lodge. And no, I wasn't drunk that time, just sitting still in full thought with the possibility of change, wondering how deep the water below us was and how this experiment I had requested could have anything to do with opening minds or hearts. We'd requested an hour afloat, and you had already retired your dry wit, your impervious questions, and yes, your sodden book unreliably shut to favor conversation. Once before, we had drifted without struggle. But on that quiet day of murky waters and jutting tensions, no words came other than benign ones. Single entities to admire what nature was doing and had done. Sprays of goldenrod, buzzing water bugs and nettle, bottom fish starkly angling, dragonflies careening out of the heavens, alive, bewitching us as we moved toward shore to ask or beg the question of whether love was ever enough.
Whoa, that will start your second book. That will start your second book. Yeah. Indeed. You tell things like a silver knife. They go right through me. There's so much in that poem, so much which is about to happen, actually.
Yes.
Yeah.
And actually, I did remember a lot about that day. And the first line was a lie, but it got me started.
What was the first line?
First line was, I don't remember much about our last anniversary.
Oh, that was just to get you a trigger start, right?
Got me in there. Yeah.
Well, among other things, you have a master's degree in the first interdisciplinary field in a certain subject. What was that?
Writing as therapy. And I thought I pulled together all the literature. You know, there's art therapy and there's also writing therapy. It's becoming more of a recognized thing than it was in the 90s when I started. As a matter of fact, I had a friend, a doctor, who wanted to work with me after I graduated. But in the Department of Health and Human Services said, there's not enough known about writing as therapy in order for us to approve your program.
But you got your master's in it.
I got my master's in it, and I got an award for the discipline, the first interdisciplinary program at Frostburg State. And I did have some informal groups at my house of my friends coming and using journaling and various discovery techniques of finding things out. Because I think, above all, writing poetry is the art of self-discovery. How do I know what I think till I see what I say? That famous quote from Auden. And that's why I want to read the poem that I was going to stay married no matter what if it killed me, until I wrote this poem.
And it has killed many people.
And it's called A State of Holy Matrimony. It's ironic that A State of Holy Matrimony actually ended my marriage. A State of Holy Matrimony. In the dark compartment of the car, only your head is visible. The jutting profile that tells me you were cut of cardboard. Your eyes like magnets drawing light to secret chambers. I imagine trailing shapes whose gauze peels back the miles between us, whose necklaces are strung out over the Ohio as we race from state to state. As if nothing had changed, not even on paper, except some inner speed. Each motion chosen only for this, as we share a single cup of coffee. Mm. No sugar, black. I wonder about deer, and if with your rifle that day you ever heard them scream, or if, like me, they said nothing. I am terrified of their silence leaping into our path. Pale faces shattering in an explosion of blood and glass. Eyes rolling backwards in a tangle of roots and leaves. We had grown together this way. Journey and destination, trivia and tragedy, joy and rage, hope and desolation. I punch in a cassette, Chopin's Etudes, before the huge truck crowds the lane, blinding us to everything but intention.
A plus. All right, Joan. I want you to remember who you are. Every time you think you're not up to writing another book, remember the absolute fabulous writing that is. Cut of cardboard, cut of cardboard. What a way to describe it.
Yeah.
Man, cut of cardboard. And what I keep talking about is honesty.
Yeah.
You know, why adorn it? Why dress it up with too much makeup? Tell what you feel. I love the line about the eyes with the roots behind them and how you came to that image. I think I find unconsciously in you a lot of nature images. Mm-hmm. And I think that is might be one of your loves. Am I right?
Oh, absolutely. I'm a gardener. I'm a lover of nature. In fact, nature of pasture was my babysitter when I was 3 years old.
What do you mean by that?
My mother let me out wandering around in the fields and the streams and dipping minnows out of creeks and going to the woods and wandering in this up the hill and down the dale.
Is that California?
No, this was after we moved to Pennsylvania. I think she was so busy she didn't have any time to watch me.
Well, and there's where
that was the best part of my life. When I was a teenager, she had plenty of time to watch me, and she did, boy.
So neglect was the best. Neglect
was good for me.
Joan Selby is bringing so much happiness to us. Let's hear another poem.
Okay. Now, here is a poem called Slug. It was written during the early 70s in my feminist days, and I'm still a feminist, and we still need feminism. But it was inspired by a film I saw in biology class in high school of a slug, an actual little wormy-looking guy, climbing over a razor blade, and it didn't bleed. Of course, I don't know if slugs have blood, but it didn't even hurt it. And I figured it was so soft, it didn't get hurt. So, and this poem was considered by Ms. They wanted to publish it, but for some unknown reason, they didn't quite work for them. Slug, and there's a double entendre there, of course. I remember one extremely delicate exposure of the body mounting a razor blade, pulling its weight over the sharp, sharp edge without a trace of bleeding. I, too, have done this without complaint, suppling the cautious, lubricated cells of my belly, lifting, because I desired to move through darkness, sharply easing the sweet white root to keep you from towering above me. I didn't mean to hide or work secretly, but you called me predatory, ugly, and grew angry because your hard soles could not crush me. I never meant to use guerrilla tactics. See, my silver trail is wet, my mouth hungry. It is useless to ignore me now, for I am soft, so soft, you'll barely interrupt me.
What a poem. Yes, soft. So, and the fact that that image from school days stayed with you for decades to become the kernel of a poem tells us a lot about a poet.
Mm-hmm.
Before we go to our final poem, who do you like to read? Who influences you?
So many wonderful poets. I love Jane Hirschfield. I love, of course, everybody loves Mary Oliver. I started to read Stanley Kunitz again, and from him I got the title for my next book, A Curious Gladness. And I thank him for that. I love Galway Canal. I love James Wright. I love Naomi Shihab Nye, who is single-handedly trying to bring about world peace. So many wonderful poets. And I have to give a nod to Doug DeMars and Barbara Hurd from Frostburg State University and the wonderful poetry program that they sponsored up there, where we had workshops with Roland Flint and Steve Dobbins and yes, workshops are very helpful. The one poem that will be in my next book is about my sister's accident, where Roland Flint asks, how does write about something we'd never talked about, and even though it was extremely painful and important to us? And that was when my sister was in a car accident when she was coming back from the prom and went through the windshield and had her whole face cut up. And I wrote a poem about that. I was going to put it in this book, but I think, and I wrote several of these poems in workshops by Doug DeMar, or the classes Doug DeMars had, and Barbara Hurd had a poetry work group at her house.
And that's Frostburg, Maryland. We need to tell everyone.
Yes.
Because you're actually recording from Shepherdstown, West Virginia, but I know you're a resident of Hagerstown, Maryland. And let us have a final poem. Joan Selby, this has been a gift to the world. Let's hear a final poem.
Thank you so much. I would like to end with a poem that I was inspired by Japanese words. The word was Miyukibare. It's called A Beautiful Morning After the Snow. And the Japanese have such wonderful evocative words in their language. They had all these different words for different kinds of snow. And I wanted to use those words in the poem without footnotes. So I put the meaning in parentheses. And it worked for me to explain and explore the idea of love being love for oneself, love for one's life, love necessarily without a partner, not necessarily with a partner, but with the contentment of having lived a good life. And I do apologize to anyone who knows Japanese for any mispronunciation. I am learning it, though. I'm trying to learn it. Miyukibare, Japanese for the beautiful morning after snow. My face is ice inside this pen and ink drawing of Hokkaido early spring. I wear a hint of Kanayuki, powder snow, a kiss of pink frost lipstick. I have come with nothing except the gift of time. It is enough to hold me since you fell away, like Hisetsu, flying snow, restoring the earth and her streams. Now you are Nayuki, snow at the foot of the tree. Yet nothing is lost, not even Sosameyuki, light sprinkling of snow. It will become the clear water that flows in our veins, the underpinning of craters and wind-stung trees. True, there were times when the Watayuki, cotton snow, caught in my throat. When in your voice was the smoke of villages, the steel and clang of estranged streets. Now I am content to honor what is left, to be part of the embrace in this forsaken place. When the Botan Yuki, peony flake snow, blows in from the mountains, I will smile and bow. I will say, ah, I will say, peace.
Part of this embrace and this forgotten place, the voice of Joan Selby. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Snippet Fund, the Rivada Foundation, Anne Arundel Arts Council, Song in the Room Women, Natalie Canivore, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Our engineer is Mike Turpin, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.